You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're all in our respective home offices, aren't we?
Curveball there.
After
back from Italy.
No longer in virtual Italy.
Very sad.
Very sad, isn't it? This is our first post our Giro podcast. What's the wine of the day today, Daniel?
Can we get on to that already? I had an Argentine Malbec last night, but no, it wasn't quite as interesting as one of the offerings from Divine Cellars during the Giro.
Il Ristorante opened, Lionel?
Yeah, but I haven't been doing Italian
selling pies and mash.
Melton Mowbray pork pies, napalm.
Melton Mowbray pork pie, Daniel.
God.
Yeah, nice.
Oh,
very nice.
Well, we're decompressing, aren't we? We're recharging.
It's been a bit of a come down, hasn't it? Certainly for the last 10 days.
Yeah.
Since the end of our Giro. Been lost.
Just like a real grand tour, isn't it? The kind of flatness. Anyway, we're going to pick ourselves up for this week's podcast. Lionel's punching there. We're going to talk this week about the new two-part film, Lance, which is about Lance Armstrong. Don't let that put you off, however.
I was going to say, we've just lost 67% of listeners.
No, there's a lot else besides, and we're going to hear some other voices too. We're going to catch up once again with Larry Warbass with his lockdown diary. Next week as well, we're going to hold a press conference. We normally do these during the Grand Tours. We didn't do one during our Giro. We thought we should talk about Lance this week because it's out and people can watch it. We're taking questions for our press conference next week. Some of you may have sent them already by WhatsApp. Huge apologies, but that number is no longer working. Please could you resend as an audio file your question to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. That's contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. You can write us questions as well, but we prefer to hear your voice. So if you can send an audio file to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, we'll hopefully hear your question and answer it in next week's episode. But we normally kick off with a news roundup, don't we, Lionel? So what have you got for us? There's quite a bit of news, really. A few things bubbling
there
away.
There is, yeah. We're edging closer to the professional cycling season resuming. A decision is expected on Monday, that's June the 15th, regarding the Tour de France taking place from August the 29th to September the 20th. I think there's a reasonable confidence that those dates will hold firm for the Tour de France at the moment. The first European stage race ranked 2.1 or better is due to be the Vuelta a Burgos at the end of July, with Strade Bianche being the first World Tour race for men and women on August the 1st, we gather.
What colour is the Vuelta a Burgos leader's jersey?
Very good question. Is it
a deep
cracker?
Red.
It's a belter. It's a purple.
I thought it was purple. I don't know. It's just
quite deep purple.
Deep purple.
There you go. I don't know any deep purple songs. Not my kind of music. Is it the Buff? Is that up your street?
Not really. No, neither. I'm afraid. Sorry about that.
Okay. Sorry.
But yeah, we're confident that the Tour de France will go ahead at the end of August on the original route from Nice to Paris. The Giro d'Italia is now likely to start with a time trial in Palermo in Sicily. Is that right, Daniel? That's what the replacement for the Hungarian stages will be, with the possibility that Hungary, Budapest will host the Grande Partenza, next year.
That is a possibility, Napalm. We expect an announcement about the additional three stages. So RCS have had to find three additional stages to replace the Hungarian ones somewhere. And we think...
Have they been in touch with you about that at all, Daniel?
No.
Looking
alas,
for inspiration?
No. I've been eagerly anticipating a call from our venue, but it's not yet materialised.
The riders have breathed a big sigh of relief at that, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well... I think there is going to be an extra mountain stage, because if you remember the stages that the race should have done in Hungary, there was a time trial and two pretty flat days. What has been reported in Italy is that there will be at least one additional mountain stage, because they're thinking of having a stage in Abruzzo, finishing at Campo Imperatore, where we've been napalm. We spent hours waiting for a cable car up in the, well, in Gran Sasso d'Italia, a very beautiful spot, but quite a tricky climb. Caused a lot of damage last time in the Giro a couple of years ago.
And the Vuelta is tweaking the route to avoid crossing the border into Portugal as well. So the Vuelta is also going to be reduced by two or three days as well, isn't it? Starting, I think, on a Monday when it gets underway. But the route for the Giro and the Vuelta, we'll see them get confirmed shortly, I imagine. There's also going to be a virtual Tour de France, 6 stages for men and women, held over 3 weekends in July on Zwift. I mean, not a grand tour as we know it, Daniel, is it? I mean, nowhere near as ambitious in its scope as our Giro.
No, a bit tippy-tappy. 6 stages. A 6-stage mince.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And
It'll be interesting to see what kind of appetite there is, both from the teams and spectators, obviously, because I get the feeling that as the real racing gets closer, then possibly the appetite will diminish for the virtual racing, pro virtual racing. Another thing, chaps, I think we're going to be looking at closely over the next few weeks and exploring and asking people about, is this idea of whether this huge block of turbo training that a lot of pros have been doing will benefit them and will have some kind of legacy, and whether it might even change their training going forward. We'll be speaking to some team physiologists about that.
I don't think you need to speak to team physiologists, Daniel. The
speak
evidence
to the buffalo.
Is staring you in the face at the moment, in my chiseled face, after 3 weeks.
Sure about
of...
that. I was actually thinking, for all your boasts about being in the form of your life, I can't really see the difference, but maybe it's just a slightly grainy video.
I don't know.
You of all people should know, Daniel, that the camera adds about 10 pounds.
These new bones under your eyes, Rich, very, very impressive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, I've been going out on my bike, having spent 6 or 7 weeks riding my turbo indoors, more than I've ridden my bike for years, and I've been feeling great. I mean, you can, we've said it a few times, but from a layperson's point of view, you definitely work harder on the turbo trainer. You pedal more aggressively than you do out in the road. And so I think we've seen from one or two riders, I mentioned Ashley Moomin Passio, I think, in a previous episode, she went out and absolutely smashed her personal best on the Rocket Corba climb, which she rides a lot, having spent, you know, 5-6 weeks indoors. So yeah, I think the interesting thing is whether it will influence training. You know, will professional cyclists train more indoors for races? I mean, could indoors be the new Tenerife?
I think one of the things, I was talking to Mitch Docker about this when we were recording a bit for the introduction to his most recent episode, and I see our colleague Jim Cotton has written a piece, having spoken to Mitch, written a piece for Velo News, and Mitch was talking about how this indoor training period has been not only without a kind of end goal really in mind, no one's really known until relatively recently what it is they're aiming for, but also that it's very, very kind of one pace type of training, everyone doing the same, you know, probably shorter and more intense efforts, but also the difficulty of coming off the back of what might be, well, it's going to be 3, 4, 5 months of training with no racing, and then going into a block of, you know, very intense back-to-back racing, and the mental aspect of not really having had a year behind you with any kind of peak and flow to it, no kind of training blocks and then racing and then rest. It's all been a bit kind of you know, beige in its lack of definition, I guess, and whether that has an effect not just physically but also mentally on the riders when they come back to race. They'll be raring to go, of course, but will they be, you know, in A1 shape? It's going to be interesting to find out. But
another just final footnote, chaps, and one thing we also need to look at in the next few weeks is the issue of dope testing that we mentioned. Well, that was a hot topic at the start of the lockdown, the fact that not much dope testing, if any, was taking place. And obviously, you know, as the races get nearer, that's going to have to be addressed if it's not already being addressed. But yeah, we'll have to look at that.
Well, Rich, we rode our Giro on the RGT cycling platform, and the Women's Tour will be held on that platform next week. June the 17th to the 19th, three stages. You can watch that online, I think, as well. Well, as the racing edges nearer, the teams are starting to put into place training camp plans, and De Koninck Quick Step have got a couple of things lined up, as all the teams will have, but they're getting all of the team together for an altitude camp at Passo San Pellegrino in Italy from July the 6th to the 23rd.
Ciro's least favourite place in the world, isn't it? Passo San Pellegrino. Because he often gets dispatched there before the Tour de France to spend some time with Vincenzo Nibali, and he hates it.
But they'll all be together training, and then we'll break out of their bubble and go and start racing at the start of August, I guess. Quite a bit of transfer news and other speculation going on, and contract renewals. That big news from Groupama FDJ, extending the contracts of Thibaut Pinot, Arnaud Démare, Stephen Kung and David Gaudu for 3 years. Quite a significant move, that, to extend contracts for that long, given, well, it certainly says something about the security of that team. The same can't really be said of the CCC team. Now, Jim Okovic had spent the best part of last year looking for a replacement sponsor for BMC, and the Polish company, shoemaking company CCC, took over the title sponsorship, but they will be pulling out, so Okovic is looking for a new sponsor to save the team again. Peter Wiening, who you probably heard from in Mitch Docker's episode Life in the Peloton, talking about the 2014 Giro d'Italia team time trial that Mitchelton Scott, sorry, Orica Green Edge, as they were then, won. Peter Wiening, nicknamed Ween Dog by the Aussies, of course, signed for Trek Segafredo at the age of 39. So good to see they're investing in young riders.
I mean, they're quite an aging team anyway, aren't they, Trek Segafredo? But the Mitch's episode on that Giro team time trial was fantastic. We spoke about it a bit during our Giro, but it was an interesting interesting stuff about Wiening and the way that he rode on the climb in particular.
And Rich, as I said when we talked about this episode a couple of weeks ago, unfortunately, I mean, I went back to watch the video and watch the clips on YouTube of that time trial, and you can see very little of what's talked about in that episode in fantastic detail and riveting detail, but it doesn't really, you know, transmit very well on the TV pictures.
That's what makes it so good. And yeah, I wouldn't like to ride a team time trial with a climb in it with Ween Dog, having heard it.
And finally, some speculation. This is solid speculation, isn't it? Romain Bardet has been linked with Sunweb, a move to Sunweb from AG2R. I mean, I don't know whether you think there are any legs in that, Daniel?
I can imagine there being, well, interest on the part of Sunweb. They could do with a rider like Bardet, and Bardet could possibly, well, some might think that he could do with a change of scenery. He's been at AG2R since the start of his career. Last year didn't go too well for him. He's talking now about really aiming for stages at the Tour de France this year. Of course, he was originally going to do the Giro. But AG2R, were they to lose him, would have to have a big rethink, because they don't really have an obvious... it's not like Groupama with David Gaudu, who is obviously sort of being groomed as a successor to Thibaut Pinot, and he's really waiting in the wings there. AG2R don't really have that. So I think they would be loath to lose Bardet at this point.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
My name's Lawrence, and I look after the go-to-market strategy for a new iWalker product called iWalker Pay. So iWalker Pay lets small businesses get paid up front for their invoices while their customers spread their costs over 90 days. It's a very new product. It's been in the market, testing in the market since February. We are kind of just doing whatever we can to get the word out there about the product during these times. I mean, with what's been going on recently, I guess lots of businesses are very understandably worried about their cash flow and about paying or receiving invoices. And I think it's understandable that businesses are struggling to pay and collect on invoices outstanding. So we're just trying to help as many people as we can.
A big thanks as ever to our title sponsor, iWalker. And if you enjoyed our Giro coverage, that's our coverage of our Giro, then it's in large part thanks to iWalker, whose support has given us some security at what's been a very challenging time for all businesses, big and small. And with that in mind, and as we heard about from Lawrence in the clip there, this week iWalker has launched iWalker Pay, which can really help businesses and customers. It helps the supplier to be paid up front, while the customer can spread the cost over 90 days. If you'd like to know more about iWalker and about all the ways that iWalker can help support your business, go to iWalker.co.uk. Well, as I mentioned at the start, we're going to be talking about Lance, the two-part ESPN film, part of their 30 for 30 series. That series launched in 2009 to mark the 30th anniversary of ESPN, and I think they've produced over 140 films.
What's your favourite?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, the one that stands out is OJ Made in America, I think. The 467 minute long film, the longest film ever to win an Oscar. It surpassed War and Peace in that regard, and it is extraordinary. Most of their films are an hour long. We've talked about a lot of them over the years, haven't we, Daniel? Watched a lot of them. One of my favourites is Once Brothers.
I think that's my favourite.
Basketball. Is that your favourite?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. The Two Escobars is also a really good one. I can't remember what it's called, but the one about Bo Jackson's very good.
This is what they want. The one about Jimmy Connors, US Open in 1991, I thought was excellent as well. But Once Brothers really stood out for me. I mean, that was just such a moving film, really. Yeah, Once Brothers is about two basketball players, Vlade Divac and Drazen Petrovic, who played for the Yugoslav national basketball team at the time that Yugoslavia broke apart. And, Divac, Serbian, and Petrovic, Croatian, they found themselves on opposite sides of that divide. And it's a story of their friendship. And it's really a moving film, very well put together and really worth watching if you can find it. Once Brothers, it's called.
It is. And It keeps you watching, and there's a real sting in the tail in that film. And in so many, I mean, the 30 for 30s are all about great stories. It doesn't actually matter what the sport is at all. And the format for the two-part Lance Armstrong film, Lance as it's called, is they've gone beyond the usual sort of 1 hour constraint in order to tell a fuller and more complete story. Interesting that it's in two parts, I think. Is there a kind of a bit like our Mario Cipollini episodes during our Giro, when we sort of recognized there were two parts to Mario Cipollini's story and tried to cover one part in episode one and the other part in episode two? Armstrong clearly very complex, and this film is the first project in a while to tell the story, but to visit him now and find out, you know, where Armstrong is and how he is now. One interesting thing about it for me was that it's directed by Marina Zinovich, an American filmmaker who's directed a lot of films about quite complicated men. Roman Polanski is one of her acclaimed films, but I first became aware of her many years ago because she directed a film a long time ago about Bernard Tapie, the French entrepreneur businessman who ran the La Vie Claire cycling team in the mid-80s. And Tapie kind of fits that description too, of being hugely charismatic and quite complicated. And this is a kind of low budget, very strange film. Basically, it follows Marina Zinovich in pursuit of Tapie for a couple of years, and she never quite manages to pin him down and get an interview. But it's a fascinating little film if you can watch it. There's no cycling in it, unfortunately. But we've all watched Lance now, both episodes. Daniel, you're in it quite a lot. I mean, the standout performance, clearly. Thanks. Was that your drawing room?
No, sadly not. I didn't even have a house, let alone a drawing room. Yeah.
It was very grand looking anyway. But what, I mean, what were your thoughts, Daniel, on it? We lived with the story of Lance Armstrong throughout his career. We've followed him since. You know, he's got his own podcast, of course, or podcasts. There was very little about that, actually, which surprised me in the episode, in the sense that this, to me, for me, the podcasts have been quite an important vehicle for Armstrong to be rehabilitated, and relevant was the word that he used as well, and that she asked him about. But that wasn't covered. But what were your impressions of the film?
I suppose the first thing I found myself, well, the first question I asked myself was really what question the documentary had set out to answer. I think the answer to that is that it wanted to establish how basically he feels about the scandal and everything that went down now in 2000, well, the interviews were mainly conducted in 2018. So, you know, have the sort of sands of time, have they changed his view, his feelings about everything that went down? You know, from the point of view of someone who works in cycling and follows cycling, maybe the question that we're more interested in and is more pressing for us is, how does professional cycling deal with Lance Armstrong? The Lance Armstrong question now, how should it deal with the embarrassing Lance Armstrong question now? And you know, that is obviously still foremost in his mind, that soundbite about staying relevant. You know, whether he wants to be or not, he's not comfortable with the fact that some of the riders in his generation have been rehabilitated and redeemed, and he has obviously not. And you know, we've touched on this question over the years as well, you know, the inherent hypocrisy of a lot of people, a lot of members of his generation having been rehabilitated, and him not. You know, I think we'll maybe talk about the reasons for that a bit later. But the documentary, what does it say about where he is in his life now? Well, I mean, I think he's someone who has tried to change, is trying to change, and it is a bit like turning an oil tanker around. You're talking about patterns, behavioral patterns that are that have their roots in childhood, and the documentary talks about that a little bit. You know, his stepfather, who was possibly, well, he was very severe, perhaps violent towards him, and you know, it's very hard to change as an adult, and I think he's in the middle of a long process, but you know, it's not complete, and you can see that in the documentary. He's still abrasive. He still hasn't forgiven everyone. I mean, you know, it's really other people who should be forgiving him or have had to forgive him. But he hasn't forgiven Floyd Landis, for example. And, you know, there are definitely sort of traits of character that people found unpalatable during his career that they'll still find unpalatable watching the documentary, and that will make it a difficult watch for some people, or something that will turn a lot of viewers that came maybe with an open mind off again.
Yeah, I suppose sitting down to watch the film over two consecutive Monday evenings, I did wonder what the kind of the point of it would be at this point. Are we at the point yet where the Lance Armstrong story is one that we can really kind of pick over in some detail? But you know, there will come a point where we'll go back over the races and we'll treat the racing for what it was, which was, you know, a highly doped era, dominated by one man, and all of the drama. And there was a little bit of that, wasn't there? You know, the dramatic shots of Ulrich crashing in the time trial in 2003 in Nantes, where, you know, that was the closest Armstrong came to being challenged, really, in that 7-year run. And also the moment where he goes across the field after the on the descent into Gap, isn't it? And I think there'll be more of that in the years to come. So it was kind of a strange point in the Armstrong story at the moment. He's, you know, he's not rehabilitated, is he? He sets out at the start of the film saying, you know, to Marina Zenovic, I'm not going to lie to you, Marina. I'm not. As if, you know, no, this time I'm going to tell the truth about everything. But it's still his truth. And I think he even makes that point that it's his truth. And so, you know, this won't be the last Lance Armstrong documentary about his career in cycling, will it? There will be more. There'll be others, and there will be some that maybe pick away a bit more at what this run of seven wins means. You know, perhaps when it gets a bit more distance. But the point you make, Daniel, about Armstrong feeling kind of bitter that he's excluded from the world of cycling. I mean, looking at the riders who stood on the podium alongside him in Paris at the end of those seven tours, Alex Zülle, Fernando Escartín, Jan Ullrich, Joseba Beloki, Raimundus Rumzas, Alexander Vinokourov, Andreas Klöden and Ivan Basso. I mean, Vinokourov is the only one who's working sort of solidly within professional cycling in a teams-based point. What Ivan Basso is...
I mean, Basso has his own team, Cometa, is it still called, a 23 team with Alberto Contador, which, you know, is definitely sort of moving up the professional cycling food chain. And might
Basso's the only one who works full time in blueberry farming. Yes. All of them.
Yeah, but the point I'm making there is, you know, Armstrong, he's still officially an outsider in professional cycling, isn't he? I mean, even he wanted to go and cover the Giro in Israel as a journalist and was unable to do so because he's still banned from the sport. And I suppose the standout moments, the thing that really stung was when he was unable to take part in the Ironman triathlon in South of France. Was it in Nice? You know, and yeah. You just see the expression on his face is so, it doesn't hide anything. You know, the fact that he's not a part of the world of professional sport, I think, burns him. And so, you know, there was a lot of things to take from it, but it's not the end of the story, is it? For those who think we should draw a line under Lance Armstrong's career and legacy and never talk about it again, I mean, that isn't going to happen, is it?
I mentioned, we were chatting earlier, and I mentioned that, you know, we quite recently spent a part of an episode discussing whether Fausto Coppi handed a bidon to Gino Bartoli or the other way around. And, you know, we're still talking about them and that rivalry. And we're going to be talking about Armstrong in 50 years, no question. And part of the reason for that is personality, not just the controversy and the achievements, although it's all wrapped up together. But what was interesting to me, I mean, you mentioned the moment there, Lionel, where the camera really lingers on Armstrong's face after he talks about having traveled to Nice to take part in his first Ironman and then having to go home again. That really, the pain of that is still very, very evident. But the other moment of real emotion from Armstrong that I saw was when he talked about Landis and how much he clearly despises Landis. And it's maybe no coincidence that I thought, you know, a couple of the really most interesting things said about Armstrong were by Landis. And it's almost that Landis has this unique understanding in a way of Armstrong that he's got under his skin somehow. One of his comments was that Landis was speaking about how difficult he found it when he tested positive after winning the Tour in 2006 to lie. He said it's hard lying to people, and we could see that in the footage. He said, Lance is very good at it. Frankly, he's better at lying than telling the truth. He's very uncomfortable being himself. And I thought that was an amazing sort of observation, which may have some truth in it. The other observation that Landis offered was about cyclists themselves, top cyclists. He said, despite the difficulty of it and the amount of time and determination it takes, the personalities are not particularly aggressive. They're often really introverted people who just like to spend time riding their bikes by themselves a lot or near other people without saying anything. People see George Hincapie and think, oh, he's a tough guy. He's not. I mean, Lance is. He's a tough, hard guy. But the rest of them are not. And all the riders interviewed for the programme, Bobby Julius, Jonathan Vauters, Tyler Hamilton, Landis himself, George Hincapie, they do all come across as diffident and unassuming and introverted. And Lance stands in really stark contrast to that. You know, he's an A-type personality. And I think that goes an awful long way. And you spoke, Daniel, during our Giro coverage about how people seldom talk about the characters and personalities of Bartoli and Coppi and talking about their rivalry and so on. But it's kind of the same with Armstrong, where we do accept that he's got this larger-than-life personality, it's a very domineering personality, but it's that personality that goes an awful long way, I think, to explaining his athletic performances, his doping, the manner of his doping, and the fact that he was able to get away with it for so long, and that he had people wrapped around his finger. You know, that moment where Pat McQuaid had a conversation with Jonathan Vaughters, and his first instinct was to phone Armstrong, because people deferred to him, even the president of the UCI.
Yes, Rich, and it's interesting to draw a parallel with another documentary about an American sporting icon that's been talked about a lot in the last few weeks, The Last Dance, which is on Netflix, and it's about Michael Jordan. And the thing we often hear about Armstrong, when people are asked why they can't forgive Armstrong, why they can't move on, they talk about the bullying, which is absolutely, you know, it's widely acknowledged, accepted, even by Armstrong himself, that he did bully people, teammates, opponents, journalists, critics. But it's not really just about the bullying, is it? And it's not really just about his personality. That's not the only reason that people can't forgive him. It's a combination of the bullying and the doping. And I always think you can almost draw up a mathematical formula, or you know, if you really sat down and picked it apart, of how some riders, including riders from that generation, have been able to rehabilitate themselves. And if we think about, for example, two examples, at the end of the documentary, Armstrong sort of rants about Ivan Basso having been rehabilitated in Italy, and others as well. David Miller is one, I think, in the English-speaking cycling world. And, you know, why has that been? Why is that the case? I think there's obviously the question of the scale of the betrayal, or the scale of the, what some people would call the fraud. Armstrong won 7 Tours de France. He didn't win 1 or 2. I think if he had won 1 or 2, then maybe this would be a different conversation. It would be easier for him to find a way back. But another one is the way some of these riders have been able to sort of narrate their own story and find a receptive audience in the media, and you know, we're part of that as well. Miller is an eloquent guy, he's an articulate guy, and I don't, you know, I'm not suggesting that he set out and sort of with a roadmap of how he would find favour again with the media, but just by virtue of the way he's been able to communicate, that has enabled him to reinvent himself to a certain extent. Same with Basso. Whereas others simply have not been able to do that. I mean, I watched an interview the other day. There's a parallel between Lance Armstrong and Riccardo Ricciotti, the Italian rider, simply because, or based on the fact that they both watched the 2008 Tour de France, or Riccardo Ricciotti watched the end of the 2008 Tour de France because he was in it and he got kicked off in the middle of it. But I watched an interview with him the other day in which he talks about Carlos Sastre winning that Tour de France, and and his instinct was, I should have been winning that Tour de France, because he might have won it had he not been kicked out for doping. Armstrong wasn't riding at that time. He watched it and thought the same thing. Sastre wasn't a worthy winner. That's what he said also in the documentary. This interview, anyway, on YouTube with Ricciotti was watched by about 1,000 people on YouTube. And it's an hour and a half interview. And he's another good example of someone who has not found the words or the way or a route back into people's, you know, sympathies or affections. And yeah, it's a combination of factors, isn't it? It's, you know, the scale of, as I say, the scale of the betrayal, and the way in which, you know, someone finds a way to sort of, you know, resonate again in the affections or the sympathies of the public.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And you can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products. I'm still going through a lot of them with my newfound love of cycling, which I've carried on after our Giro. I've been out riding on the roads, been going out into Surrey and absolutely burning up the tarmac. Daniel, don't smirk. I can see you there. with your Mappy hat on, smirking away.
Well, I've been on my bike this morning, haven't I?
Sorry, you can get 25%. Let me finish this first. You can get 25% off your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. Sorry, Daniel, you've been cycling.
I've been cycling
as well,
this morning. I've been cycling a lot, but for practical reasons.
Not for fun.
I could be coming for you.
Fun is beneath you.
Yes.
Lionel, you've been getting out your bike as well.
I have, yeah. I've been going pretty well, relatively speaking, of course. But our Giro...
Absolutely flying.
Yeah, I've come out of our Giro in good form.
Well, you always come out of a Grand Tour, a bit weary, leg weary for the first week, and then the form, he's pinging now. Yeah. He should be absolutely sweet spot of form. Let's carry on talking about Lance. I mean, one of the things, I suppose, that cycling fans would have watched it for is whether... to find out whether there was anything new in it, anything that added to our understanding of what happened and when. And I suppose I mentioned the phone call from Pat McQuaid, the UCI president, to Armstrong after he'd been tipped off by Vauters that trouble was brewing. That was a bit of a revelation or further confirmation that, there was this closeness between the UCI president, whether it was Pat McQuaid or Hein Verbruggen before him, and Armstrong, and that
which, let's not forget, they absolutely denied time and time again. And I thought it was interesting that Pat McQuaid kind of led us to the conclusion that the relationship was close between Lance Armstrong and Hein Verbruggen, McQuaid's predecessor as UCI president, who of course is no longer here to defend himself or to confirm or deny. That I thought that was interesting.
We went from that revelation and an understanding of that closeness to footage of Pat McQuaid basically writing Armstrong out of history in the next scene, which was an interesting thing to watch. From my point of view, I guess it was interesting to hear Armstrong talking about his comeback, and obviously that was his big blunder. Without the comeback, as he acknowledged, there wouldn't have been the downfall. We can see that set off this chain of events. But to get a sense now of his own reservations and misgivings about the comeback, even before it had started. And there was always this weird, having ridden for US Postal and Discovery Channel, to then come back and ride for Astana was always a bit odd. And it was strange to see him in Astana kit and as part of that team. And he said that he felt that himself when he, got even just a few weeks into his comeback. And he says, he was trying to explain to his partner that it felt like a bad idea. He says, I should have picked up the phone and called everyone and said, I'm not doing it, I'm not feeling it. That would have been the smart thing to do. I would have dodged everything, he says. He says, it was exciting for a little bit, but it quickly got weird. And when he went to training camp in Spain to join up with his new Astana teammates, I think he felt then that, he didn't really know what he was getting into, and it didn't feel right, and he didn't follow through on that instinct. I thought that was... obviously said with the benefit of hindsight, but it was interesting to get a sense of his own misgivings at that time.
Well, you always get the sense, even towards the end, even in the last two or three years of most riders' careers, if they've had a long career, that they start to feel almost slightly alien, like aliens in the peloton. They start to feel slightly disoriented, and like they no longer have quite as much in common with their peers, and particularly the younger riders coming through. So if you add to that, and if you think about what Lance Armstrong was doing between 2005 and 2008, and it wasn't a normal retirement. He was mixing in circles, as the documentary described, that are pretty unusual for an ex-professional cyclist, sort of going to premieres and the Oscars and so on and so forth. And you can well imagine that also going back into a sport that was really, I think, at a watershed moment, particularly in terms of doping as well. And if you think when the Garmin team and what was then Slipstream started to become more and more prominent, and the Colombia HTC, what became the HTC team, was also in the process of establishing itself as one of the best teams on the world, with a USP of kind of transparency. And you think about all the kind of bloodletting, literally almost, that had happened with 2006 and Operación Puerto. The 2006 to 2008 were really the key years in terms of, I think, changing the mood and changing the ambience in professional cycling. And also the culture and the peer pressure switching around, and it no longer being expected and encouraged for riders to dope even by their own teams, and the peer pressure started to work the other way, and you started to see riders kind of protesting and speaking out more, and teams speaking out more, teams building their reputation on being clean. So I think for Armstrong it would have been a bit of a hell of a culture shock.
Well, and interestingly, Daniel, this might be a good time to hear from Larry Warbass again, his latest lockdown journal. We haven't heard from him since before the Giro, but there was a period of time where Armstrong was so toxic that riders wouldn't speak about him at all. And what's been interesting the last year or so, I think, in particular, is riders of Larry's sort of generation willing once again to talk about the legacy of Armstrong in a slightly more nuanced way, as Larry does in his latest journal. Let's hear from Larry now.
Hey guys, this is Larry Warbass, and you're back in lockdown with Larry, although I think most of us aren't so locked down anymore. So that's good. There's been some progression in the last 3 weeks. Hopefully everything goes okay. Obviously, as most of you have probably seen, things have been pretty crazy in the U.S., so hopefully we don't see another flare-up in the virus or anything. Beyond that, pretty much just still been training hard here at home. Not a whole lot has changed in the last 3 weeks. Enjoyed listening to the cycling podcast Giro coverage, especially the episodes on Cipollini and Max Chiandri, because I actually spent some time living in the same town as Max when I was a neopro, so I know him quite well, and yeah, really enjoyed those along with some of the other episodes. So they got me through some of my long rides, which was nice. Also watched the Lance documentary, and I actually really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was well done, and I mean, I personally thought it was pretty balanced. I enjoyed a lot of the interviews because I've, you know, met quite a few of those guys over the years, and, you know some of them pretty well. So it was kind of a good watch, and, you know, there weren't any like crazy revelations or anything, but I do think it's such an interesting story. And it was cool just to see a little more. I know, you know, he's a very polarizing figure, and you know, I saw a lot of people refuse to watch the documentary, and that's fine. You know, everyone can do whatever they want. But yeah, I enjoyed it, and I thought it was pretty good. I guess in general with Lance, a lot of people hate him because I think a lot of people felt deceived over all the years. But the one thing I think that a lot of people easily forget is just that he did bring a lot to our sport. And, you know, especially here in the U.S., it really wasn't on the map at all until he came around. And, you know, he really, really put the sport on the map and, you know, brought a lot of attention and, you know, consequently funding to our sport. So for me, I really only have to thank him for, because I think without him I wouldn't be a pro cyclist. So both in terms of I probably would have never found cycling, and I don't think there would have been the same avenues for me to enter the sport and progress to become a professional if it weren't for him. So I think being a young American at that time, I watched, a lot of his last tours, and yeah, I was a big fan when I was a kid, and obviously it was disappointing when all of that came out, but yeah, I guess it was what it was, and I wouldn't say I hate him or anything, so I'm still grateful for everything he did for our sport. Yeah, so that's that. I'll be curious to hear what all the guys on the podcast thought of that and the documentary and, their kind of take on all of it. I'm guessing Richard wasn't a fan, but yeah, we'll see. We'll see what everyone had to say. Oh, and good job, Daniel. You had some really nice parts in there. I thought enjoyed seeing Daniel's cameos in the documentary. But yeah, beyond that, I'm hopefully returning to Europe at the end of June. Get back into the training rhythm over there, and we have some training camps planned for mid-July before hopefully an August restart. So I think it's pretty interesting to see how different countries are starting back in different ways. I see that Slovenia is actually still hosting their national championships on the planned weekend, so the 21st of June. That's pretty crazy to already have a road race then. I'm sure those guys are excited to be able to do that. I mean, it seems pretty soon, but if they, say that that's safe, then I guess that's cool. I don't really know what the situation is there. I also saw that Belgium should start racing in July, but I don't know what kind of races they're going to do, if that's for like just Belgians or for everyone or what. And then, yeah, hopefully we will all get started not too long after. So I'm really eagerly awaiting that restart, and I'm really looking forward to getting back to Europe and getting to train on my roads around Nice, getting in the mountains, because while it's really nice riding here, it's not like we have giant mountains and stuff like that. So I really think Nice is some of the best riding in the world. And I'm really fortunate to live there most of the time. So I'm pretty excited to get back there. Although we do have really nice weather here now. So it's actually was 30 today. We'll be in the mid 30s tomorrow. So really hot. And then, I think it should tail down to around 25. So it went from like snowing to 30 degrees in like 3 weeks, but I'll take it. So, okay, everyone. Hope you've had a good last few weeks, and hope I'll have some exciting news to share with you guys each of the coming weeks until we start racing. So, talk to you soon.
Well, Larry Warbass there, giving us his latest lockdown report. And he touched on the film and on his feelings about Lance Armstrong. Some people might be uncomfortable with that.
Biased, of course, as a fellow Texan.
Yeah, not a Texan. Actually, Larry, I don't know why you think I wouldn't have liked the film. I did like the film. It'd be interesting why you thought that. But anyway, but I've heard him and Ian Boswell and Joe Dombrowski all make similar comments. I mean, Boswell and Dombrowski came through Armstrong's development team, but it is true for our generation, for their generation, that they owe their careers in cycling to some extent to Armstrong.
Yes, Rich, and it is. If we think about what I said at the start of the episode, whether one of the key questions of this documentary is or should have been, or one of the key questions now from our point of view is how professional cycling deals with Lance Armstrong, the Armstrong question. It is quite refreshing that we've reached a point in time where riders can they're not scared to be honest and talk about how he influenced their cycling when they were growing up, because that is the case with a lot of them. We're right in the heart of that generation now, which would have grown up watching the Armstrong tours. And I think we spoke during our Giro when we did the episode about Max Schachmann and Paris-Nice. We also made the same point there about the German riders and Jan Ullrich. It was a real frustration for them for a number of years that they couldn't talk about the fact that they had grown up idolizing Ulrich. And that just underlines really how awkward and difficult and impossible to resolve this question is, that, you know, Larry and his peers are not saying by any stretch of the imagination that they endorse or even, you know, necessarily forgive Armstrong, but that the racing happened. We have to try to make some kind of sense of it. And I totally take the point, as was made in the documentary, that a lot of riders in that generation did dope, but they did, you know, we think, respond, react to the drug in different ways. So we don't know who the best rider is. We don't know who should have won the Tour de France in those years. But the racing remains. And, you know, some of it was very entertaining, and a lot of people got excited and swept away by it at the time, including, you know, a lot of the guys who are in the peloton now.
Yeah, I mean, just taking that up, I mean, Larry Warbass was 9 years old when Lance Armstrong won his first Tour de France, and therefore 15 when Armstrong won the last of his seven tours. He was a kid. He was watching the fairy story on TV at that time, getting into cycling. You know, the cancer survivor who came back and crushed the world with these fantastic attacks. You know, he was the best year after year after year. It was a fairy story. I mean, it was a compelling fairy story, but it was a fairy story. It had no more truth to it than, you know, Father Christmas. I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, you can't get away from the fact that the whole thing was a fraud. And I think one of the things about this film, and
if any kids are listening, take that back about Father Christmas.
sorry everyone.
But and Napalm. I mean, if we say that it was all a fraud, then, you know, you have to. You have to really apply the same standards to a lot of what has happened in the history of professional cycling.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. I'm not saying that you don't, but I think that, you know, that if we're not careful, we get caught in this thing of saying, well, it wasn't just the doping, it was the bullying. But there's a third strand to it, and that is the fraud and corruption that was, you know, was running in parallel with this. I mean, there's a moment in there where Tyler Hamilton says that, you know, he'd left Lance Armstrong's team. He was riding for the Phonak team. He won the time trial on Mont Ventoux at the Dauphiné in 2004. And as he understands it, you know, Armstrong got on the phone to the UCI and said, you've got to test this guy and, you know, catch him out because he's becoming too much of a rival. I mean, that is the inference that the film, the very strong conclusion that the film leads you to. And that isn't really put to Armstrong. But right from the start, you know, it's not just the bullying, it was the trolling and the gaslighting before we knew the term. You know, it's the denial. Everyone who had some evidence against Armstrong, whether it be drug packaging being dumped at a French service station during the 2000 Tour de France, or whether it be Betsy Andreau saying that Armstrong had admitted to taking the whole menu of drugs while he was being treated in hospital for cancer. You know, these things were brushed off as kind of figments of bitter people's imaginations. And I don't think it's possible to just sort of sweep that aside and say, oh, well, that's kind of fine because he's a compelling, magnetic personality. I think it all has to be put on the table and looked at on its merits. And just to sort of go on the kind of the fraudulent aspect of it, let's not forget also that Armstrong basically bet on himself to win Tour de France after Tour de France in order to recoup some more money, you know, pull the cash lever on some more money. He basically took out insurance policies. He and his team took out insurance policies that would pay out huge sums of money for him winning consecutive editions of the Tour de France. And those policies were paid up. And I mean, that's another sort of, that was a real interesting point in the documentary that I thought that Marina Zinovich was going to kind of pick away at, but it was just, you know, covered and then sort of moved on. But this is actually a really interesting strand of the story because it's a sort of the first downfall that leads to the eventual whistleblowing by Floyd Landis and the eventual investigation by Jeff Nowitzki. Because in 2001, Lance Armstrong and his team took out this insurance policy with a company called SCA Promotions in Texas, where they would get paid a bonus for winning the 2001 and 2002 Tour de France. That would be $1.5 million. Then they'd get another $3 million if they won in 2003, and $4.5 million if they won in 2004. And of course, Armstrong won all of those tours and collected $10 million. And when David Walsh and Pierre Ballester's book came out in French, it wasn't published in English, LA Confidential, Bob Hamann, the boss of that company, SCA Promotions, which had effectively taken this bet, they started to smell a rat, and they wanted to get to the bottom of it. And they wrote to Armstrong and said, we're going to need copies of your medical records. Armstrong's reaction to that was to basically turn it around and force this issue to arbitration. You know, he was kind of standing up and facing down any suggestion that he might have been doping. And so they went to this arbitration, and that is where Betsy Andreu says on the record that Lance Armstrong had said in the hospital room that he had used EPO, growth hormones, testosterone, etc. And that's the first kind of real thread that starts pulling away at the legacy, because in that deposition, under oath, Lance Armstrong lies. And without those lies, Jeff Nowitzki arguably might not have taken quite so much of an interest, because he felt, working for the Food and Drug Administration, the federal agency, he felt that the case was one of fraud against US Postal Service, that US Postal Service had sponsored this this legacy, this run of victories, and had suffered some kind of damage to its reputation. Now, of course, that investigation was closed down, mainly because the US Postal Service did fantastically well out of the association with Lance Armstrong, doping or not. But the fact that Armstrong had lied under oath meant that Nowitzki could, you know, he had something to go on. It meant that he could then compel other people to speak. And as we know, Jonathan Vaughters, Tyler Hamilton, Frankie Andreu, Christian van der Velde, and so on, spoke to Nowitzki under oath, knowing that if they lied to a federal agent, they would be in serious bother. And so the whole kind of the house of cards starts toppling in 2005 with the SCA Promotions case. Bob Hamann is a former multiple US champion bridge player. He founded a company called SCA Promotions, and a lot of their business was insuring against holes in one in golf, or if there's a sports fixture, an American football match, where there's a prize for kicking a field goal from the halfway line, or shooting a basketball from the halfway line, they would offer a form of insurance to cover the prize money for large competitions. They also covered bonuses in sports contracts, and that was how the Lance Armstrong connection came about. Armstrong had insured his first two Tour de France titles in 1999 and 2000 with another company, and had taken a payout, and was looking to do the same on a more ambitious basis when he got in touch with SCA Promotions, or his management team got in touch with SCA Promotions. Bob Hamann lives in Texas. He's 81 years old now, and I got him on the phone a few days ago.
Well, right now I'm retired at my desk in the company's office. The report I got, it was pretty sympathetic to him, but I didn't watch it, so I can't comment.
So tell me, what were you doing in the late 1990s? Tell me about SCA Promotions and what your regular business was.
Well, they were ranging all the way from golf hole-in-one and halftime entertainment to, other chance-based deals. If we could get the odds right and security, we'd take it. Let's take the mind games. Chess, checkers, Go, backgammon, poker, etc. So chess, Go, checkers are purely computational. Bridge, you're dealing with an unknown problem. So there are a number of judgment factors in figuring out what it is. You've got to be able to put yourself in your opponent's shoes and say, if this were the situation, what would they do? Now, it's in a sense, it's easier to play against expert players, because if that's the situation, there's a high probability that they'll take a given action. If you're playing against some bozo who doesn't know what the hell they're doing, the card they played, all you know for sure is maybe it was the card nearest the thumb. So, however, there's so many mistakes, the fact that you play worse from the standpoint that you can't figure out what they're doing. I mean, you have a reasonable idea, but you're not, your judgment against expert players, except when they have an opportunity to find deceptive plays, is going to be a little bit better than against bad players, but the bad players make so many mistakes, it doesn't matter.
So in your business with SCA Promotions, you would have to understand the events that you would be basically betting on, really. You'd have to weigh up what the odds would be.
Well, in the Armstrong situation, we made two major mistakes. One, we were operating under the assumption that the Tour de France themselves would have had an adverse situation with Armstrong, and that him winning would not be a good thing for them. But actually, it was a good thing for them because it brought the American audience to bear on it. So the organizers of the Tour de France and the cycling union, Armstrong had them in his pocket. Not so much the organizers, but definitely the cycling union. So they were protecting him. Well, we were approached by an insurance intermediary. And of course, they posed it as a U.S. Postal Service bonus when the reality was Lance betting on himself. Chris advised me not to take the deal. But being far too smart to listen to somebody, I sucked myself into it. Well, the original proposition was that he had won twice in a row. So going into the 2001 season, they said, how about a bonus if he wins both 2001 and 2002 with more for 2003 and an initial kicker for 2004? So we came up with a price, got Swiss Re to participate, and we were kind of, the first pay event was when he won 2002. So we paid it and they, that was $1.5 million. That was $1.5 million. Then there was $3 million that was due if he won in 2003 also. And another $4.5 million if he capped it off in 2004. So now June 2004 rolls along and David Walsh's book with Pierre Ballester gets published in France. John Bandy was fluent in French. We got a copy of the French edition. He read it and we suddenly started getting pretty concerned. So now 2004, Getty prevails, and I write that we're going to need copies of his medical records. And recent allegations have forced us to inquire. And he responded with a lawsuit to compel arbitration. Well, first, we'd agreed on no neutral arbitrator. And the guy who was the neutral arbitrator, but the problem was that we had to have a really good case. Because even though he's a neutral, for a guy in Texas to rule against Lance Armstrong in a marginal situation would have been very difficult. So our party arbitrator is a very smart guy, a fellow named Richard Chernick. The neutral operator was Faulkner. And Chernick says, you're going to lose, and you better get it settled. So we settled it. Well, over and above this, it cost us a little over about $2.75 million in addition to the $4.5 million. So we were out an additional $5 million by the time they add up all the costs and the fact that we settled for more than we had originally owed. So that was an expensive undertaking.
So this was pivotal, really, because this was when Armstrong had to go on the record at the deposition in 2005.
Yeah, but the arbitrators didn't necessarily believe her, and he denied it, and it was he said, she said, and Frankie's testimony wasn't all that great, and maybe it wasn't even material to the deal because there were some questions of insurance law that were present. So the point is, we got beat. First place, he didn't even represent that he hadn't doped in the contract, and when that wasn't part of the contract, we were relying on the rules of the tour. It's very hard on an incentive contract. You have to accept the adjudication of the ruling officials as to who won. The reason we got some of our money back was that effectively he lied to the panel. And then he confessed on national TV to Oprah. Well, we liked it. This was no the surprise was he confessed, not that he had done it. We knew he had done it. The company didn't get its money back at the end. The company got some of its money back. We were net $5 million loser on the deal. Legal costs, additional costs, we got $10 million back. We lost. It's as simple as that. We wasted a lot of time, energy. I don't get emotionally involved in these things. It doesn't matter. You can't change the past. He's just another hustler. Somewhat higher stakes than most, but the world's full of them.
Well, that was Bob Haman of SCA Promotions in conversation with Lionel. And we're going to hear now from Marina Zanovic, the director of Lance. I mentioned earlier that she directed a film much earlier in her career about Bernard Tapie, the controversial businessman, politician, actor, who ran the all-conquering La Vie Claire team in the mid-80s that featured, of course, Bernardino and Greg LeMond. But Marina has also made films about Roman Polanski, Richard Pryor, Robin Williams, and now, of course, Lance Armstrong. And so I started by asking her about what appears to be a theme in her career, that she is drawn to the stories of complicated men.
It's so funny. I just kind of follow my nose, and I never... It wasn't until my husband said, well, you make films about complicated men, that I thought, oh, you're right. You know, I just kind of chase stories. So my first film was about the struggles of independent filmmakers. So that I'd say maybe all my films are about willful men. I don't know if they're complicated, but I guess if you're willful, you end up being complicated. My second film was about Tapie, which came about because I saw him act in a movie and I thought he was an actor. And the director of the film said, the star of the film is in jail tonight. I didn't know why he was in jail. I thought he was an actor. I thought it was maybe drugs or something. So I kind of backed into that story by thinking he was one thing and then finding out that he was the owner of the Olympique de Marseille soccer team, and he'd taken an acting job in a Claude Lelouch movie to pay his legal bills. And it was like, are you kidding? Like, I never in a million years thought I'd find a better character than Bernard Tapie. And that was like in 1998, right?
Yeah. He is a great character. And it's a great little film, that, actually, because you were kind enough to send me a copy of it, a VHS, I think it was, but it was a great little film. With Armstrong, did you come into it with an awful lot of knowledge about Armstrong and about the sport of cycling?
Not really. I mean, I read the books and, you know, I watched Alex's film. I had seen Alex's film before, but several years prior, I watched Stop at Nothing. I mean, it's kind of like I knew about Lance because I knew about it, but I wasn't an expert on it. I knew about him through Alex because Alex is a friend and mentor, so I remember when he went through that experience and what that was like for him. I made a film about Robin Williams, and he was friends with Lance. So I kind of, Lance would pop up in footage and what have you, but I didn't know really anything, and it's almost, I think, better when you come in not knowing, just because you come to it fresh and there's kind of like a naivete about the whole thing that I think helps you, because you can look like you don't know because you don't know. So there's something about when you're interviewing people and you don't know something, they tell it to you in a better way than if they think you're an expert on it. That's been my experience. Like, if they really think you're asking and you're really listening, they really kind of open up and tell you more than they would otherwise. Otherwise, everybody's kind of they're like glossing over stuff, I find.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I mean, as you delved into the world of Armstrong and cycling, you'd have, you know, been more than aware of how much noise surrounds him. How did you sort of manage to filter that out? But also a linked question: how did you? One of the things about Armstrong is that everybody says that his desire to control the narrative, to, you know, through his very sort of dominant personality, to really exert his control, his charisma over people. So how did you balance that? Being aware of all the noise that surrounds him, and being true to the, you know, the subject that you were studying, while also not allowing yourself to be swept along by that?
Well, it's a fine balance. You know, I think that I'm sophisticated enough that I could know on the one hand that books that I'd read or movies that I'd seen, people said that, you know, he would charm them and, you know, take them and use them up. But at the same time, I could have that knowledge in my head, but also be open to talking to him and hoping that he, in those ensuing years of a lot of therapy and kind of looking at yourself and your actions and trying to understand who you are and why you did things, hoping that he's in a different place and being open to his, you know, personality and intelligence and charisma and humor and lightness on his feet. Like, I can keep all those ideas in my head and know that, you know, maybe he's trying to control the narrative, maybe he's not. You know, I honestly felt that he had seen the darkest days already. He had survived them. He is lighter on his feet because that part is over. And to me, that was like a real dark period that we would, you know, try to understand and get people to talk about. And it was like one of my favorite parts of the film, just because it's kind of like when Christian Vandeveld says, you know, like, George said I should go and see him, and I went to see him, and, you know, like, I had to go have a drink after having a drink with him. It's like, he wasn't in that place when I made this film. And I think that when I made the film, he was in a different place than he is right now.
Did you like him? I don't know if that's the right word, but did you like him at the end of the process?
It is the right word. I did like him. I did like him. I enjoyed spending time with him. We all did. We enjoyed filming him. As I said, he's very funny. He's very light on his feet. He has a lot of fun in his life. You know, you would come away from being with him going, God, I just don't have enough fun in my life.
Well, we announced towards the end of our Giro that we have partnered up with Katusha to launch some new cycling podcast clothing, T-shirts and cycling jerseys. They're really beautiful designs, lovely colours, and they're taking pre-orders now. You can register an interest in having a piece of cycling podcast kit. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com /shop and you'll be able to go through to the Katusha site from there. And Katusha are offering 10% off all their stuff to our listeners. If there's anything else on the site that takes your fancy, you can use the code KTCP for a 10% discount. And that will be available as soon as possible. Obviously, factories in Europe, their stuff is made in Europe, and the factories have been in a state of limbo, but they're opening up again now. So hopefully the jerseys and T-shirts will be rolling off the production lines soon. We have a couple of other episodes that have come out, part of the Cycling Podcast family. Service Course is a detailed look at the Hoob Watt Bike team with some fantastic interviews that Lizzie Banks has conducted. Lizzie, who rides for Bigla Katusha, presents Service Course with Tom Wally, and the latest episode is out now. It's a really great listen. And Explore is out now as well, the latest episode of Explore, presented by you, Lionel, with Ian Boswell and Hannah Troop.
Indeed, yes, and it features Hannah's interview with Emily Chappell, who has written a couple of books, the most recent one being about her experiences at the Transcontinental, the bikepacking endurance event that crosses the continent.
Well, listen, we heard from Bob Haman of SCA Promotions and Marina Zanovic, the director of Lance. I mean, one of the things that I enjoyed, I would say, about the film, and which I thought was good, was Marina's willingness and her desire clearly to tell a rounded and a kind of balanced story. She was looking to, and that there are moments, you know, of, we hear from a lot of people who clearly don't feel very warm towards Armstrong, and understandably so. And you know, Lionel, when you were introducing your chat with Bob Herman and explaining the background to that and the fraud and the corruption that was at the heart of that, it's very difficult to hear that and not feel quite angry all over again, as we all, you know, have felt at various times following and writing about Armstrong and the damage that he did to the sport. You know, there were moments in the film where a slightly different side of Armstrong was revealed, or certainly glimpsed. You know, his relationships with his family, and she tried, I think, to talk about his work with cancer patients as being, clearly it became part of the story, and he admitted that he used that as a shield, but his actual, you know, individual dealings with cancer patients seem, from what we can understand, to have been, you know, sincere and meaningful, to not least to those patients themselves. And so she tried to paint, I think, as full and as balanced a picture as possible. And I think the film benefited from that. Whether, you know, that turned you off as somebody who's been burned and scarred by Armstrong and doesn't want to hear from him ever again, it might well have done. But, you know, in the interest of making this balanced film, I thought that served it well.
Apart from, you know, a few exceptions, people are capable of doing good things and bad things. And it's possible to say that you like something about Lance Armstrong whilst also really disliking other aspects of what he's done and what his personality are like. I mean, you know, people are complex, and I think that attempt at kind of showing a 360 degree view of him as a person was probably the thing that I took from the film the most, really. I mean, just the interaction with his son Luke, who's a promising football player, and just even there, you know, the conversations about the doping question, the whatever you think of Lance Armstrong, you can't watch him talk about the hurt he felt when his son was basically getting bullied because people were saying his dad was a cheat and a doper. I mean, you can't, all right, people might say he's such a sociopath that he does fake it, but I just don't think you can fake that. I mean, he must feel that as well. And there are aspects of that you can say, well, that's the consequence of your actions, live with it. Fine, but also that's a very real human consequence of those actions. And to see those little human interactions with his son, and then hear, you know, when he asked about whether or not you know, his son should dope, and he says basically, well, not as a freshman in college, but, you know, if it was the NFL, that's a different question. And it's almost like you get lulled into this feeling of empathy for Armstrong, and then he sort of just blunders everything, sweeps everything off, well, the table again, yes, by saying, well, you know, but it's, you know, if there's some money to be earned, you know, we'd have to talk about
it. Yes and no, Napalm. I think I think he also, some people would say he deserves credit for not censoring his answer on that. And, you know, we talked about the issue of whether he's believable and, you know, how much he lies. But, you know, there are times when he is telling the truth and people just simply find it unpalatable. Mm. And we can't have it both ways. You know, there are other occasions in the book. I'm sorry. There are other occasions in the film, for example, you know, when he's asked about whether he regrets what he did or whether he would do it again, or whether it was a difficult decision to start doping again when he came back from cancer. And he replies with the sort of unvarnished truth, which was, no, it wasn't a difficult decision to start doping again. And, you know, maybe some people would prefer him to sugarcoat it and maybe tell a bit of a white lie there, but he doesn't.
You're absolutely right, Daniel. And I thought the other thing where you get a little glimpse of that, of his truth, if you like, is when he talks about whether or not he should have mitigated in his eventual confession. I mean, when he did confess, he went all in and he said, I needed a nuclear meltdown and I got it. You know, he lost all his sponsors in 48 hours. His whole identity as an athlete was stripped away from him overnight. People who believed in him, were suddenly confronted with the truth. And something that, again, Richard, as you say, you know, that you could, the Cancer Foundation was used as a shield. He used it as a shield in interviews. You know, there's a couple of examples where he's saying, you know, come on, would I take risk with my health having recovered from cancer? You know, basically deflecting away the question about taking performance enhancing drugs. But the sincerity when it comes to helping people and raising an awareness of a disease that people still very uncomfortable talking about. I was dismissive of that at the time, but I think seeing it now in the kind of the cold light of day, now that he's been removed from that charity, and the charity doesn't have the same it doesn't have the same profile, does it? I mean, so you can't divorce the good things from the bad. They're all part of the same package.
Yeah, he drew a distinction, didn't he, between using his own illness, his own cancer, as a shield, but not using others, or you know, certainly not, you know, using individuals who he was having contact with and trying to help. And yeah, I thought that was quite interesting. I mean, another interesting part for me was just seeing Armstrong age almost before our eyes. You know, and you know, he is getting a bit older, isn't he? About the same age as me. But anyway, he just seeing him still kind of plugging away, and I thought the film ended on a pretty poignant note. He was sort of running through deserted, kind of cold, wet streets. I can't really remember whether that's the case, but that's my impression, that he was in that moment seemed quite lonely. You know, there was this, he's wearing a kind of strange, almost like a triathlon outfit, leggings and all in black. And he's out for this kind of what looks like quite a lonely, punishing run from which he doesn't seem to be getting an awful lot of pleasure, although that's often the case when you see people running. That's the impression. But it was, there was something quite sad about that, I thought. That's if you have, you know, over the course of the previous 4 hours, I suppose that's the test of whether you've developed any kind of sympathy at all with Armstrong. And I guess I maybe had through these glimpses of warmth or of a slightly different side to him, maybe that had developed a little bit in me. But you know, it's I as you said earlier, I think Daniel or Lionel, I can't remember which of you said, that we can't, it's fanciful to imagine that we're just going to sort of move on from Armstrong and forget that he existed and not return to the story and to Armstrong himself. We're going to keep doing that. And personally, I find the Armstrong story still interesting enough to do that. And I certainly sat through the 4 hours of this film pretty engaged by it and interested by it. And I imagine that in another 10 years, there'll be another one and I'll probably sit through that as well.
Yeah, I'm still interested in the story, Rich. I mean, I don't know how you chaps feel about the sort of still forensically picking apart the slight inconsistencies in the story, or maintaining that he hasn't told the whole truth. I mean, there are some, you know, there are some curious little details in this film. For example, the issue of when he started doping with particular substances. I mean, there are definitely some, you know, very creditable and well-read sources on this matter who say that, or who believe that he started using EPO in 1993 and not, as he says in the film, I think in 1995. And there's also the issue, the slight, what could be an inconsistency about the hospital room incident, and what he said in the Oprah interview in 2013, the start of 2013, when he was asked, is it true what Betsy Andreu said, that, you know, did you sort of confess to the oncologist or consultant who was there at the time? And he said, I'm going to lie down on that. I'm not going to take that on. And she, Oprah Winfrey, kind of moved the interview on. And in the documentary, he now says he doesn't remember. You know, I think one of the dangers with these interviews, and, you know, having been interviewed for this particular documentary, I can sort of vouch for this. you know, you sit there and you're interviewed for an hour and a half. And this is not to say there's any sort of foul play on the part of the director, but sound bites are extracted and then they exist until the end of time for people to pore over and identify inconsistencies in. And, you know, sometimes I think they can be over magnified. I'm not sure whether that those two instances, for example, about the hospital room, whether that was very deliberate of Armstrong to say back then he wasn't going to take it on. I mean, is that just a, you know, another way of saying he'd forgotten it? I don't know. But I don't know about you guys, whether you feel there's any more mileage to be had. Does it, you have any interest in still going back and revisiting those, you know, those details, really? You know, what he took, when he took it?
I think I'm, as I was sort of hinting at there, I'm probably more interested in Armstrong, the person, and how, you know, he becomes reconciled to his story, his legacy, and what and who he is now. And I guess one sort of one other point worth making is that when you see him sitting in, you know, in relative luxury and clearly still having a pretty good lifestyle, you do think that he got away with it. You know, obviously his reputation suffered, but financially, well, materially,
I did point out to you,
he's doing fine, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, we were discussing earlier in the week an incident, an episode in the film that a lot of people have mentioned, quite an amusing episode where he cuts his finger on a potato peeler, I think, when he's preparing dinner. And I happened to notice that there was a bottle of Italian red wine open on the kitchen worktop, and it's a bottle of Tignanello, which is a very, very expensive Italian wine, not the kind of wine that you or I would uncork on a school night, sort of 100 quid a bottle sort of stuff.
I mean, this is where it's so complex, isn't it? Because I, you know, I can feel myself getting quite angry when I listened to Lionel earlier describing the financial kind of heist at the heart of this, really.
And but yet, then also, Rich,
yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to say, the problem is, from the perspective of now, we look back at all of that history and assume that there was kind of definitely a goal, and everything was done to go towards that goal, rather than an opportunity presented to itself. I mean, I think when you hear Bob Herman talking about how he took that on and weighed up the risk, you know, it was just an opportunity for Armstrong and co to, you know, hey, if we can bet on ourselves, we can get some more money here. You know, that's how this game works. Well, let's play this game as well on the side, a side hustle almost. And I think we do have to also remind ourselves that, you know, that the whole picture, you know, it's broken down into its little constituent parts, and everything was serving one goal, which was to keep winning the Tour de France, of course. And really, that it's a lesson of allowing a sort of ruthless ambition to go completely unchecked. And I suppose my final takeaway would be just how kind of weak and willing the UCI was. You know, this potential global star, a fairy tale story that could, you know, project cycling onto a global playing field and elevate cycling through Lance Armstrong. It was an opportunity for the sport as well. And I think it's too easy to say that that this is bad because it was all founded on doping. You know, there were some good things have come out of it. You know, even look at the slipstream team coming out of it and offering opportunities. I don't want to just kind of give Jonathan Vaughters a free pass here with that comment, but there are, you know, kernels of good that have come out of a great deception, which let's not forget, it is now in the open. I mean, we all know, imagine in another universe where we still had to fate Armstrong and people knew and were still having to be silent and were being silenced. I mean, that would be awful.
It's the ultimate sort of final comment on the film and on Armstrong himself, I suppose, that we can say that he got away with it and he didn't get away with it. You know, he got away with it in some respects, financially, materially, but in having those titles, in having his name up there with the greats, and, you know, and I think, again, go back to that moment, that real kind of most revealing moment of the film for me was Armstrong's face and his the hurt, the rawness of the hurt still, that he wasn't able to do an Ironman, and so that must eat away at him, I would imagine.
And Rich, we always talk about it in terms of, well, it is a Hollywood story, and we talked about it in terms of being a kind of fairy tale. The whole Armstrong parable was a bit of a fairy tale. But, you know, Hollywood always likes morals at the end of the story. And at this stage, you know, 10 years on or whatever it is, the moral of the story, one moral of the story and moral of the documentary, this particular documentary, is, to my mind, so about forgiveness. And I think the people who have done best in this story, as they often do, are the people who have been able to forgive. And, you know, Christophe Basson, for example, and Filippo Simeone were held up as heroes, rightly, at the time, because they made a stand against Armstrong. But they are also the heroes of this story, to my mind, and others as well. And I think Floyd Landis, based on what we saw in the documentary, you could also put in this category as well. They're heroes because they've been able to forgive. I mean, I heard an interview with an Italian website or Italian podcast the other day with Filippo Simeone. We spoke to him last year at the Giro d'Italia, but he went even further in this Italian interview, and he talked about how he'd forgiven Armstrong and how he wished him all the best and how he still considers him the winner of those Tours de France. I mean, we don't have to subscribe to that sort of bottom line, but, you know, he's moving on with his life. Christophe Basson's life never really stopped, and he never really dwelled on this question. As far as he was concerned, he was a lot luckier than Lance Armstrong. He had an upbringing and a family and a sort of value system that was a lot healthier than Lance Armstrong's, and he never really dwelled on the kind of incident for too long, the famous incident with Armstrong in 1999. So, you know, I think it's about forgiveness. You could say sort of forgiveness is the antechamber to redemption. And this means that if we're able to forgive Lance Armstrong, we're going to redeem him and he's going to be a hero of the sport again. I don't think that's going to be the case. The crime was too big, and it covered too much time. I mean, you know, this was 7 years in the biggest race in the sport, the race whose importance transcends the whole sport. And that's also why we can't forget it, because it occupies a huge space in the history of cycling.
Do you not think, though, that one of the things that we are missing out on, and Richard, this is your going back to your point about the stories you'd like to hear. I mean, there will come a time where we'll be able to look back at those seven tours and talk about the spill on the Passage du Gard, which Armstrong profited from and others lost out, or, you know, his duel on Ventoux with Marco Pantani, or, you know, Ulrich's crash in that time trial, or the moment on Luzzardi Den where his bag...
I hate to plug my own book, but... When I did the TAP a few years ago, which is a collection of chapters about great or dramatic stages in the Tour, I interviewed Armstrong about his stage win in Limoges in 95, just a couple of days after Fabio Casartelli's death, and the incident at Luzzardi Den in 2003. And I spoke to him exclusively about those two racing moments, which obviously encompassed an awful lot else besides, you know, tragedy and you know, crashing and all the rest of it too. But those two chapters are about those stages on their own. They're not devoid of the context and the doping and all the rest of it, but the what's central to them is the drama of what happened on the day. And so I tried to do that because I did recognise even then, this was a few years ago, that was where we would end up. And I think if we're not there already, we're certainly headed there.
But it doesn't resolve every difficult question. I mean, where does he, in practical terms, where does he sit in the sport when there are, in 10 years, you know, receptions organised and, you know, anniversaries where every tour winner is invited, or, you know, every world championship winner is invited? I mean, what does the sport do? I mean, and that is where I still sort of sit here and scratch my head, and I don't really know the answer, and I don't really know whether there is a good answer.
Well, it's completely demolished the kind of greatest riders of all time lists, or the greatest races of all time lists, because it is sat there like a great big black smudge across 7 years of the Tour's history and across the sport's history. Well, I'm not a big fan of those lists anyway, so I'm not particularly bothered.
Had there been a better rider or a better cheat than him, you might say, and had he only won the Tour twice or three times, he would probably still be in the role of honour of the Tour, and he would probably still have all those kind of laurels and accolades.
Yeah, he bet too big, didn't he? Should have kept it believable.
Yeah. Well, there we are. That should probably be the final word on Lance, the film, and Armstrong for a while. If any of you are still listening, thanks for staying with us.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I hope my last comment isn't misconstrued as it's okay to cheat a little bit, just don't cheat too much. I mean, that's not, you know, that was a flippant comment.
Editor, take out that caveat, that qualification from Lionel there. I think we know what he meant. As I said earlier, next week we're doing a press conference. Please phone in your questions on anything at all. Leave a WhatsApp voice memo at +447971338205. But we should leave it there. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.